Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
And now we are at the interview part of the show. Today we have a writer that has writes a lot of true stories, and the one that caught my eye was, of course, Fire in the Big House, and it's America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. And he's got something else he's working on, so we're going to talk about those. Thank you for taking the time, Mitchell Roth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Mitchell, let's start with what led you into writing these kinds of stories?
Well, sometimes, since I'm one of the few historians that's in a criminology department in the country, I basically look for stories that have a criminological bent and that have never been told before, and try and write books and kind of discover, you know, why it hasn't been written about. And my last book, Fire in the Big House, was such a book. I mean, it was the worst prison disaster in American history. 320 inmates died in a fire, and yet we know about, you know, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and all these other ones with substantially less victims. So, you know, I'd always wondered, well, why didn't they write something about it? Why didn't they write a book? So, you know, I think part of it is because they were prisoners, considered kind of non-entities, and I was wondering why Columbus, where it took place, Columbus, Ohio, why they don't even have any type of memorial or anything like that. You walk by the Shirtwaist Factory and there's a memorial there. So anyway, you know, I looked deeper into it, and I found a lot of parallels with the prison overcrowding and America's love affair with the prison in the modern era. You know, remember, this took place in 1930, and, you know, so, you know, they had a lot stricter laws back then. They were had longer sentences, just like today. People were being locked up for, you know, lots of new federal crimes. You had prohibition going on, and et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, I did a lot of research in the archives, and I was really, you know, there's a lot of serendipity when you're writing a book that, you know, no one has written before. And I heard from someone, found out I was writing this, and they sent me an interview they'd been doing with a survivor of the fire in the 1980s, and they never ended up doing anything with it. And so she sent me a copy of that. And prisoners rarely record, you know, their experiences in prison, so that really helped. Another person that helped was the crime novelist Chester Hines. I don't know if you're familiar with of him, but he was like, you know, he created these African American detectives that worked in Harlem, And he was in the prison during this, and his early work is based on some of the experiences in the fire. But in any case, you know, until I think about 5 years ago, it was the deadliest fire in any prison in the world, until one in Honduras recently. Mm-hmm. And it took and it killed in less than an hour because of the smoke inhalation.
Why do you think that is? But like, not so much the killing part, but why do you think such a large fire that killed so many is just never talked about? Is it because of something they did wrong?
Well, I think you know, there's they weren't real sympathetic victims to a great extent. I mean, you're talking about rapists and murders and all that. You're not talking about immigrant women working in a, you know, in a sweat factory. You're not talking about, you know, people that, you know, were somewhere, you know, just at their job. You're talking about people that are in there, you know, doing time. So I think, number one, I think most family members, you know, probably don't want to, you know, bring them up and kind of memorialize, you know, their relatives in jail. And so, you know, you don't have a lot of accounts from any family members, and really virtually none from any of the prisoners from that era. And so I think, you know, that's a big part of it. And, you know, I was walking around the city of Columbus, Ohio, you know, sure, there's been a lot of history there, but, you know, since they tore the prison down about 20 years ago, you know, I guess a lot of people don't realize it was downtown. It was one of these big houses. And, you know, no one knew about it. And just like the book I'm working on right now about this, you know, double family annihilator. And then my previous book to that was called Convict Cowboys, and it was the first history of the Texas prison rodeo. Nobody had ever written a book on that either. So, you know.
How do you find these stories? How do you find these, actually? Like when you talk about the convict cowboys and this big disaster and the fire, how would you find out about them?
Well, quite often I'm researching another book and I come across stories, and I feel like I know a lot about a lot as far as history of crime and punishment and so forth. And being older, I've heard a lot. And, you know, so it kind of, but when I come across something, so, and I had never heard of it before, you know, I make a note to maybe look at it later on. And in the case of Fire in the Big House, you know, that I was writing a book, a textbook on crime and criminal justice in America, the history of it, and came across this, and it was, you know, curious because it did have some ephemeral impact on, you know, prisons around the country, making them a little safer, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, so I come across these things. This book that I'm working on right now on this guy, George Hassel, he killed his family of four in 1917 in California, buried them under the house. About 9 years later, he's in Texas, marries his brother's wife after the brother died, and ends up murdering the wife and her eight kids almost 9 years later. Meanwhile, they haven't found the bodies for the first four he killed, and he doesn't admit to it and tell them where to find the bodies until right before his execution in Huntsville. So, you know, a lot of people don't know this story because, you know, it brings up a lot of other subject matter, because I teach courses on serial homicide and mass murder, and there's a little bit of both of these, you know, classifications, you know, in the story of this character. The way I heard about it, about 20 years ago, I had a student in one of my murder classes, and he said, well, you know, my great-grandfather was the fifth white person electrocuted in Texas. And, you know, like he was proud of that. I said, congratulations, you know, like he won the Nobel Prize or something. So I said, well, you know, do you have any, you know, family documents or whatever? And he goes, oh, yeah, we've been researching the history for a long time. And he brings me this, you know, big history with some pictures and things like that of it. And I held on to it knowing that this might be something I want to do in the future. And, you know, this the past couple of years have been a time where, you know, I finished all my writing projects and was I wanted to do something different. And it was a perfect time to, you know, to, you know, take on this project, you know, and, you know, the character is bigger than life. I mean, just this guy, George Hassel, you know, he would expectorate in the courtroom. He could hit any object that, you know, you could believe. He strangled 11 kids with his bare hands, you know, in the two events, and not a shred of remorse. And, you know, just an interesting character that I'm learning more and more about as I, you know, search Ancestry.com and all these others. And what I found is almost every story about him is wrong. You know, the dates are wrong. Everybody, you know, that's written about him has used his confession kind of as their template. And his confession is completely out of whack when you, you know, actually look at the background and find out certain dates that he couldn't possibly have done this or that. But he did do these 13 killings, that's for sure. So got to give him credit for that.
Was it easier for someone like that to commit these types of crimes and get away with it back in 1917 as compared to now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is that, you know, they've been, his common law wife and three kids were reported missing by the family in 1917. And, you know, the police who went to the house didn't even dig or look under. Today you would have, you know, more technology for looking under the ground and stuff. And, you know, the only way they found out that the bodies were there is George, you know, told somebody and they drew a map and sent it to the cops in Whittier, California. And so you would have thought the first investigation, you know, would have been better. But then I've seen similar investigations, you know, in the modern era where people, you know, are being held in the backyard and workers come to the house looking for someone being abused and they're held in the back and they never find them. So, you know, police work, you know, depends on the training, you know, of the police. But today, you have many less serial killers and things like that simply for, there's less linkage blindness between police forces and so forth.
Yeah. Well, you'd have Nancy Grace out on the scene.
Yeah, shrieking at somebody.
Yeah, it'd be on the news.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's this type of news sells. I mean, once they, you know, the articles about this guy are legion, and you know, he was, you know, kind of you know, known throughout the world and throughout the United States. And as I was researching these articles, I'm finding, you know, some other stories of other criminals that I had never heard of. In fact, I came across this guy that I'd never heard of before, and he had a restaurant, a bar over in San Antonio, and apparently he had alligators, and he would, he was a bluebeard, and he would hire a woman, he had an affair with her, and in some cases kill and feed to the alligators. And you know, so I'm thinking this might be my next book. Maybe this will be my Texas Bluebeard series. You know, I don't know.
Go with it.
Yeah.
Do you find that the justice system nowadays and the way it works, and when I bring up Nancy and stuff, do you think that too much is televised and the action that happens in the courtroom is probably a bad thing, or do you think it's an okay thing, or where do you stand on how it is now?
Well, you know, I love to watch these shows and all of that. You know, it's you know, it leads, it leads type thing. You know, you see a lot of repetition in the stories and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think you know, in a lot of cases, there's an edifying effect on it. You know, basically, maybe it might open up somebody's eyes to, you know, abuse in the family. They might be able to connect the dots, you know, through some type of domestic crime or whatever. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, it depends on, you know, how you, you know, if you like true crime movies, true crime books. I mean, it's mostly an entertainment factor. You know, a lot of the TV shows, in fact, you know, really don't. They're great recruiting tools for college. We have a forensic science program and we have a body farm where I teach. And a lot of people, you know, want to get into the forensic science because they watch CSI and all of that stuff. And, you know, I've had students that say to me, well, you know, I didn't know you had to be good in science. You know, because they're watching it on TV. So, well, if you don't like biology, you know, forget about it.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it serves its purpose. I don't think most of the shows, you know, are, you know, overly scandalous and or romanticize any of the characters. I get kind of tired of seeing the pantheon of serial killers, though. you know, John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy, you know, the Hall of Fame of serial killers over and over and over again. You know, but, you know, Americans, you know, are very educated about the history of serial killers in America. And that's one of the few things they're educated about as far as history. Because I mean, I wish there were as many shows about, you know, crime fighters, you know, or, you know, lawyers or, you know, somebody involved, you know, constructively in the justice system. But people like these case studies of criminals because they are fascinating. Especially because half the time you really never understand what, you know, what their purpose, you know, or motivations were in their crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough one. I was sort of thinking more along the lines of, you know, like some of the cases where the whole trial is presented through television and on daily basis because...
Oh, know, yeah.
You know, because it really affects. Like we've had Kirk Nurmi and we've had a lot of people that have been in major trials, even Marsha Clark and all that, and I they always talk about how stressful it was and how the media would, you know, pictures of the nude pictures of them or this or that, or they put on weight, they changed their hair, all this stuff. And then a lot of the people watching it kind of are, you know, people that hate them and there's people that love them, and I don't know how you could do your job with that much.
Well, I think it's kind of hard, you know, doing your job, especially if you're the defense quite a bit, you know, let alone the prosecution, because there's a tendency sometimes for people to either identify or fall in love with the, you know, the perpetrator. You know, they get a big following. And also, too, there's a certain vigilante, you know, kind of part of this. You know, you're being tried by the media to a great extent. You know, if you're telegenic, you know, it works to your favor. If you're not, of course, it detracts. And, you know, for the people working on the scene, the Marsha Clarks and the F. Lee Baileys and so forth, and the rest of the, you know, people, and even today, a lot of the ambulance chasers, They I think a lot of them use it much like politicians use being a politician to become lobbyists. I think, you know, lawyers use this, you know, sometimes to get their own shows later on because, you know, they get a following as well.
Yeah.
But I there's very few, you know, long-term cases anymore, you know, that I've seen. You know, outside when I think of the Jody Arias case and a few others. So anyway, I know what you're saying though about how, you know, you have people that, you know, vilify the person, and I don't think people are paying much attention to, I gotta tell you, to the lawyers at all. They're listening to the stories and stuff, and, you know, the lawyers that can kind of keep their interest are the ones that I think are the ones that are remembered.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Now, in your in the book Fire in the Big House, I was thinking, so that was an actual fire that happened in the Ohio penitentiary. Now, that was an overcrowded penitentiary. From what I understand, it was had almost doubled the amount of people it was supposed to have.
Actually, triple.
Oh.
And, a lot, you know, they had 4,500, close to 4,500 prisoners, and, you know, it was originally, you know, meant for around 1,500 or so. And that was the thing with the Big House movement of that time period, is, you know, basically filling them up with prisoners, these large turreted, you know, almost castle-like, you know, edifices. And, you know, it was way overcrowded. And one of the big problems, too, is, you know, looking at the technology of the prisons at that time, the locking technologies, for instance, you know, the cells didn't all open at once. You had to open each one with a key. And there was no training, very little training for officers, and they were very afraid to act on their own simply for the fact that it was a great job to have during the Great Depression, and so they didn't do anything unless they were told to do it, you know, pretty much the officers.
Wow.
And so they, you know, they didn't know whether to let the guys out when the smoke started, you know, they were looking for the warden and so forth. I mean, it was just a combination of a lot of errors. And you had people that just gone into prison for not paying child support that day that died. I mean, there's a lot of stories like that. You know, people were just on their first day in prison and they died in this, you know, terrible fire.
So how many died in that? Was there 320 or something like that?
320, and then there were two others that died. There was kind of like a riot that took place afterwards, and a machine gun from the National Guard went off by mistake and killed two people that were sleeping in one of the cells. And so, you know, really indirectly, 322. And then there was others that were transferred to another prison that had another fire that killed some of them. And so, you know, you know, it depends what you add, but 320 died from smoke inhalation, basically.
Mm. So when you have something like that, now, did they ever figure out why the fire started?
Well, that was, you know, there was all kinds of reports at the time, all kinds of investigations, and initially they thought it was some type of electrical short or some electrical fire, but as it turns out, you know, after a sequence of events, it turns out it was an arson that went wrong. Four of the prisoners were, you know, tied into this, and apparently they had lit the fire. It was supposed to go off while everybody was in the dining hall, but because of the winds and all that, it didn't go off until everybody was back locked in their cells. And so of the four that were kind of tied into this, two ended up taking their own lives, hanging themselves in the prisons. So it took a while for them to figure out it was arson. They had it wasn't until they found a kite being passed between two of these prisoners and it was brought to their attention.
Wow. That's just crazy. And now, so I guess they had no regulations or very few regulations, because you mentioned how it was not only overcrowded, but, you know, it wasn't very sanitary and they didn't have adequate food and things like that. So they didn't have the regulation that they do now, or?
Well, they even had gas lighters for their cigarettes. there was a form of gas that they used that, you know, was definitely, you know, it was not fireproof. And they would often make their own fires in their cells to smoke out bugs out of their mattresses and things like that. So when people smelled the smoke, you know, they didn't, you know, pay much attention. It wasn't until
this Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We saw the smoke.
Did they get in trouble for having the overcrowding and the you know, dirty conditions and the bad food?
No, you know, most people didn't care. You know, most people, you know, we're on the cusp of the Great Depression, and even today, people think, you know, they deserve what they get if they end up in prison. I mean, I'm in Texas; it's 95 degrees today, and some of the prisons don't have air conditioning. You know, so even today in the 21st century. And in the winters, sometimes the toilets freeze, so you get ice, you know, because there's no heat. And there's very few people that really care about those things.
Wow.
It's kind of like my book on convict cowboys. It starts in 1931 when they introduced this rodeo. And back then, they didn't think it would be a moneymaker or anything, but it turned out that people were willing to pay to watch, you know, them trying, you know, these death-defying feats that even a rodeo guy wouldn't do in a arena. And so the money that was made from this was used to buy them dentures and, you know, artificial arms and legs and things like that. So it was for their recreation and also for their medical upkeep, because Austin wasn't giving any money to the criminal justice system in the 1930s.
Now, how do you think the prisons will fare in something like the COVID-19 that's going on?
Oh, it's good. You know, those are absolute incubators. I mean, you already have, you know, antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis and other things in that. And it's just, you know, a disaster waiting to happen. And you have a lot of geriatric patients also that, you know, they have separate units with a lot of the older patients that have a lot of medical problems. And, you know, who knows how many of them have contracted it or how many have died. You know, I don't trust any of the record keeping at this point because nobody really knows anything still about anything. You know, they're just guessing. But, you know, no, it's just, I think, a disaster, you know, waiting to happen as far as, you know, deaths of prisoners because the prisons are crowded. You know, America has like 5% of the world's population and, you know, probably 25% of the world's prisoners, you know, so yet crime has been going down for years. And so how do you explain it? You know, it's maybe a conundrum or, you know, a paradox. America has a love affair with prisons, you know, simply it.
Now, when you say that, do you think it's that they love putting people away, or do you think it's because it's like a business, and when you run it like a business, they look for numbers?
Well, it's, in certain communities, I think the business aspect is really important. If you notice, they usually build prisons out in rural areas. And it, you know, it supplies jobs to a lot of people in the area, and unfortunately, it creates big problems. Most of the people that are in prison are from inner city somewhere, and most of the people that are out in the urban rural areas, you know, are farmers and, you know, people that have really never met people like these prisoners before, you know, which isn't great. But there, I don't think there's any community that would refuse to have a prison built in their backyard. And they, you know, they're constantly crunching numbers. I mean, that was the thing is, prisons, when they were first, created, in the, late 1700s, early, 1800s, they had to be self-sufficient, in every respect. And the prison designs that were best at producing lots of goods, very cheaply, were the designs that survived. And the ones that didn't, you know, of course, you know, fell by the wayside. So money has always been and profit has always been a big part. Today, though, I wouldn't say it's profit as much as, you know, just paying the bills. You know, just, you know, having them, for instance, raise crops that they can use, you know, for food, raising livestock that can be used for food in a lot of prisons. You know, it's a zero-sum game, that's for sure. You have just trying to maximize the profits. The problem with doing that is, you know, you can't have prison-made goods competing with free-world goods. So you have a limited, audience to sell, you know, your goods to.
So now you being a professor in criminal justice and criminology, if you could change anything about the system instantly, the whole justice system or the court system, the prisons, you've done a lot of work in the prisons for writing, what would you change about them?
Well, I would obviously have a lot more alternatives to prison, especially for nonviolent offenders. I mean, you have a small group of violent offenders that commit a large part of the violent crimes, and I think that they should be locked up and at least trained. I would introduce some, education in the prisons. I mean, a lot of the prisons used to offer courses where you get high school education, college degree, including the Texas prison system, but they don't do that anymore. They don't have these Pell Grants and that sort of thing. So, preparing them to get out, and also too, putting, like, a lot of them are, have been doing drugs or alcohol, when they committed their crimes, and put a lot more effort towards that side of, that side of the picture, like they do in Europe. Europe's one of the few continents probably where they don't have an overcrowded prison system, although, you have some problems in some places, but they rely on alternatives to putting people in jail. So, it's been messed up for so long. You have to get the interest of, the population. And one of the critiques of the Obama era was that he didn't start working on criminal justice reform until the end of his his terms, and I think that that's very important, as much as fixing the infrastructure of the country and that sort of thing.
How easy do you think it'll be to convince Americans that there are alternatives to prisons? Because I think that's a pretty tough road to hoe,
Yeah, well, I think as the younger generations who are less, tied to any specific, punitive environment, I think, they're the ones that are going to be making the changes. Just like we're seeing the changes, with gay marriage and all of that, and, marijuana use, and, just having an open mind to, making it a better world. So I have a lot of hope for the next generation taking over from all the, old white men, basically, that are, keeping everything as it is and really not changing anything, just giving lip service because it's so easy. Because as it is, older people really are, unless they're well-educated, are usually, not in favor of, any type of real big prison reform. And also, too, uneducated young people. They just have to understand, the racial, disparity that's in prisons and the death penalty. And right now, the decline of the death penalty is the best sign, at least in Texas, the best sign that I've seen, that now you have a majority of people that if they had the choice between executing someone or keeping them in jail for life, they would go for the jail and life. And I think, looking at trials and things like that, people are much more educated about the mistakes that can be made for, people being innocent and being executed. So I think, those types of shows that we were talking about before, I think that's a very important role that they play. So people are much more knowledgeable about, DNA and bad witness identification and things like that.
So when you actually write one of these books and you've been writing, do you hope, what is it that you want people to get out of your book? Like if I finish reading one of your books, like The Fire in the Big House, what do you want me to walk away with?
Well, first of all, I'd like you to walk away saying, I never knew that before. That was, and really kind of, you learn something. So I want it to be a learning experience, obviously. And I want, and I write, I use an interdisciplinary, type of research. I tie in a lot of different things. And, I'd like to appeal to a wide range of people. And then I like to end it on a note where, you know, you can get some type of parallels with today. So, you know, it's just not stuck in the 1930. So, you know, I like to follow it up to the present and try and, you know, add that to the lesson. You know, what we're doing today as what we were doing in 1930, have we learned anything since then? You know, that, so, you know, I'd like it to be, and I'd like it, of course, to be entertaining as well.
So where do you see yourself going now? Like, what if you plan on to keep writing books? I know you're doing the one on George Hassel, but are you going to keep on doing this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I have probably my biggest book coming out in October, and it's called Power on the Inside, A Global History of Prison Gangs. And it's the first history of prison gangs around the world. No one's ever done that before. So I examined, you know, prison gangs in, you know, Australia and New Zealand and Singapore, Thailand, Native American prison gangs in America. I mean, it's very, very wide ranging with a lot of historical research. And so that was a big undertaking. And, you know, Antarctica is probably the only continent doesn't prison gangs, you know, that I know of. I mean, the penguins look like, you know, kind of shady characters, but anyway, this book, you know, I worked on for, you know, kind of a couple of years along with another book, and it's got 80 pictures showing different prison gang members. It gets into, you know, the whole, you know, while it can be used by researchers and academics, it also has a lot of really interesting stories where the impact of colonialism, for instance, on prison populations, places like, you know, Australia and New Zealand with the indigenous people, you know, that are locked up. I mean, who would have thought there's more people in gangs in New Zealand than in the army? You know, I mean, a lot of this, you know, people, you know, have no clue about. And so anyway, I enjoy, you know, doing this, but I'm thinking about this. I've done two books. I did a book called An Eye for an Eye, A Global History of Crime and Punishment. It's mostly from a non-Western perspective. And I'm happy to say it's been translated into Chinese and Croatian and Turkish and published in other parts of the world. But I'm not, you know, I don't want to take these big projects. This working on one murder case to me is, you know, is great. So I think I'm just going to write, you know, research murder cases that have, you know, kind of, you know, some relevance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I'm just wondering, when you write about the prisons, the gangs in the prisons, do people just take on the same habits that they do in the outside world? Like, we have gangs in a lot of the major cities. Is it the same
thing? That's a very good question. That's a very good question. Most of the prison gangs were imported from the outside. But they're, you know, bringing in, you know, their gang allegiances and so forth. But there are prison gangs that were created, you know, in the inside originally. And, you know, over time have kind of morphed as younger prisoners have got into it. And, you know, just looking at the, you know, prison gangs are very important to the running of prisons all around the world. You know, they call it informal governance. So, you know, basically, you know, law enforcement, I should say correctional officers and their administrators have found it, like in Latin America, and parts of Africa, and you know, would never be admitted in the United States, but you know, they let the prison gangs have a lot more autonomy than you would think, and the prison gangs have a reason for not wanting to get into a gang war, because what's important for them is protecting their revenue streams in prison, and you can't do that when, you know, everybody's killing each other, so you need to have some freedom. So, you know, Latin America, of course, has a huge, you know, prison overcrowding problem, has tons of, you know, prison gangs that kind of self-govern. It really is. I mean, they create their, and they don't just, you know, get involved in that. In Latin America, for instance, some of them, they provide health care and education. I mean, they might be teaching someone how to pick a lock. It's some type of education, you know. Well, and so they take on all of this. And in Asia, in places like Thailand and Singapore and even Bali in Indonesia, they all have prison gangs. And they all have, you know, their own different, you know, social networks, and they provide, you know, kind of a, I guess, some type of balance within the prison system.
Now, that's interesting. Now, so when we watch series on TV or shows or miniseries and Netflix, when we talk about prisons, what comes to mind to me is HBO had that Oz series.
Right.
Do you find that to be fairly realistic, or is that just totally off base?
Yeah, I saw a lot of episodes of it. I won't say I saw the whole series, but I think it had a lot of reality. You know, basically showing, you know, the people that call the shots, for instance, the power that they hold. I mean, you have these racist gangs in prisons, for instance, where they might kill on sight, but yet they might sell drugs to each other. You know, I mean, there's a prison gangs are very pragmatic. You know, so they might have a philosophy that they subscribe to, but they don't necessarily hold to it if there's something that they can benefit from. And, you know, it's one of the things I came across is looking at people that these hybrid prison gangs, or looking at people that are mixed heritage. What prison gang do they join when they go in? For instance, if you're an Orthodox Jew and you you're in prison, you know, and you need to join a gang, or kind of, you know, so usually they end up with some type of white gang. Asians usually go with Hispanic gangs. So, you know, it depends on, you know, what part of the United States or whatever. And I was surprised to find the Native American gangs, you know, a number of them in places like Minnesota and Arizona, Washington State, and that sort of thing. And these are, for the most part, were imported from the streets. A lot of the gangs were imported from, you know, urban areas like Minneapolis and Phoenix and those types of places.
So in a way, they get put in prison, and they kind of go to each other because they're familiar with their own behaviors, right? Like as a gang.
Well, that, but you know, more so for protection, and also too, you know, if you're with a particular gang, you know, you're basically protected, you know, from, you know, sexual attacks and that sort of thing, or being extorted. But, you know, a lot of the gangs, you know, violate their own rules. For instance, in South Africa, there's something called the number gangs. And, you know, they were threatening the Blade Runner. Remember Oscar Pistorius?
Right.
The runner? Yeah, when he went to prison, they told him, you know, they had to put him in administrative segregation because they were going to go after him. Because they thought he was too big for his britches. And, you know, it just, you know, they have these long traditions, and if you listen to their creation sagas and their myths and that sort of thing, if you trace them back, there's usually, you know, kind of a kernel of truth in that. But, you know, they make everybody, you know, learn, you know, a particular history of the gang. They enforce discipline within the gang, you know, like you can't go and just punch another inmate in most cases. But what's changing is the newer generations of prisoners going in. They're less willing to, you know, follow the old rules. They used to have something called the convict code, where you don't snitch, you don't do this, you don't do that, you don't steal from another inmate. So younger prisoners coming in, and also, too, a lot of the older prison gangs, they had blood in, blood out. You had to, you know, take blood to get in the gang, and the only way you got out is in the coffin, basically. And the newer people going in, they say, nah, I'm not doing that. And so you have gangs like Tango Blast, you know, in Texas, you know, has over 100,000 members. And, you know, basically they, you know, if they want to hit somebody, they hit somebody. They join Tango Blast and they go back to their original gangs when they're on the streets. But if you join a gang in prison, in most cases, you have to go back to that gang on the streets. You know, there's no, you know, separation. But we're seeing a lot of these rules changing, you know, as, you know, a different, you know, mentality is entering the prison system.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, do you have a website or a place that people can go to find out about you or your books and all that in one place?
No, you know, I've been too lazy to do that, to be honest. I mean, I have my, you know, my email and Facebook, you know, I can be contacted on, and, you know, I don't mind that at all. And Amazon has most of my books, and so they usually have, you know, some reviews or information on those. You know, but I probably should do that. You know, I complain that no one buys the books, so maybe you sell more books that way.
Yeah,
I noticed there's a lot of entrepreneurial people doing crime-related topics, and I'm not very entrepreneurial. Although I did Convict Cowboys was optioned for a TV series or a movie, so so anyway, see how that goes.
Just takes one. Anyway, so well, we'll have you linked up to our site as well, so people listening can do one click and check out your books. Our guest has been Mitchell P. Roth, and we've been talking about a lot of his books, recommend them a lot, and Fire in the Big House is the one that kind of I touched on. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thanks for reaching out. I was very happy to be here.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.